This podcast is brought to you by the American Enterprise Institute.
If you like what you hear, please subscribe, rate, review, and share.
Thanks for listening. Here's our show.
What in the hell's going on?
What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I don't know what the hell he's talking about.
You don't have to know what the hell is on it.
What the hell's the matter with these guys?
We don't know what's going on.
What the hell's going on?
Who in God's name knows what it's all about?
Hi, I'm Danielle Pletka.
And I'm Mark Thiessen.
Welcome to our podcast, What the Hell is Going On? Mark, what the hell is going on?
Well, we are talking today about new evidence about the damage done by pandemic school closures. The New York Times had a big story, which was based in large part on data from our own Nat Malkus at AEI and our scholars here about what the data says about pandemic school closures 4 years later. And I just want to read a couple of lines from this so people know what we're talking about. This is the New York Times. Today, there is broad acknowledgement among many public health and education experts that extended school closures did not significantly stop the spread of COVID, while the academic harms for children have been large and longstanding. Remote learning was a key driver of academic declines during the pandemic, research shows. A growing body of evidence shows that pandemic school closures came at steep cost to students, more time spent in remote and hybrid instruction. In 2020-21 school year was associated with larger drops in test scores. The New York Times analysis of school closure data, I should add, from AEI, and results of the National Assessment of Education Progress show. Recent test scores from spring of 2023 show that students overall are not caught up from their pandemic losses. Students in districts that were remote or hybrid longest still had almost double the ground to make up compared to students with districts that allowed students back for most of the year. I could go on, but the evidence is clear. The data has come in. The school closures were an absolute disaster for our children. We've made up a little bit of the ground, but not nearly enough. And this is going to have lifetime implications for this generation of kids.
Right. I mean, that's exactly true. And the self-same hectoring New York Times wrote another article about this topic in which they said that basically kids are making up for those learning losses, making up for some of the problems that are follow-ons, what actually, you know, I think what Nat correctly calls, you know, the real long COVID, unevenly. In other words, the kids who have two parents in the home, the kids who are in higher income school districts, the kids whose parents show more responsibility, they are recovering much faster than kids who don't have two parents, who are in poorer districts, who are minorities. And the problem, of course, is that the federal government loves to throw money at this, and they've thrown money at it, and now they're going to insist soon that the states start throwing money at this, and money doesn't help if you don't have a fundamental recognition of what the problem is, which is that these school closures actually hurt these kids.
100%. And the other thing Nat has documented in a new report that AEI just put out is that now there's been an increase in chronic absenteeism as a result of the pandemic. And one of the reasons for that is if you look at just the workplace right now, people always used to come into work, and then they stopped coming into work during the pandemic, and it's been very hard to get people to go back into the workplace, and especially in jobs where they don't have to be there, right? A lot more remote work now than there was. There seems like a permanent culture shift in the workplace. That culture shift has happened in the schools, too. I don't think a lot of schools are offering remote learning anymore because they're trying to get the kids in, but the kids got into the habit of not coming into the classroom. And so absenteeism has gone through the roof. And then you've got also the pandemic unleashed a mental health tsunami on these kids. It wasn't just that they weren't learning in the classroom. There's a lot more to school than just what you learn in the classroom. There's sports, there's clubs, there's drama, there's just the social interactions at lunch and hanging out in school with your friends and seeing your friends. And all of that was taken away from these kids. And when you do that to kids at a younger age, a lot of them don't recover. And so, you know, there's probably a mental health aspect to this absenteeism as well, and the learning losses that are persisting. This thing has just done such a disservice, and all of it for nothing, because kids were not at risk from COVID. And we knew that early. Most viruses affect the elderly and the young disproportionately. This one affected the elderly. We knew early it wasn't hurting kids. and yet we kept the schools closed, and the teachers' unions insisted that we keep the schools closed, and it was in poor and minority districts where they kept them closed the longest, and they've been disproportionately affected. So this is a racial problem. It's an absolute national disgrace.
It's gross. You know, Mark, it's funny. I don't know whether you know. You may not know, but I like to have music on when I'm by myself working. And so I always listen to Australian radio. And on the station that I listen to, this is not the non-sequitur you think it is. And on the station that I listen to, there's an ad. And it starts out and, you know, it says, you know, it starts out with a kid answering the question, what would you love to do most? And, you know, he says, oh, I'd love to go to a, you know, an amusement park. And another kid says, oh, I'd love to go to the cricket because it's Australia and they're weird. And then this last little girl says, I'd love to see my friends. And why? Because she has cancer and she's missing school. And so they're raising money for these kids who are sick and who are missing school because they recognize the ill health effects and the devastating social effects of not being with your friends, of not being with your teacher. And yet, right? The nerve of these people, because of course Australia had the longest lockdowns in the world, but the nerve of all of these people, and they exist in our country as well, that they recognize this when the kid has cancer, and yet they did this to vast masses of kids in America. They said, you can't be with your friends. You can't be with your teachers. And not only can't you be with your teachers, but if you're in public school, you can't ever learn synchronously with your classrooms. That's only for private school kids whose parents have a ton of money. That, to me, is also absolutely gross.
I agree with you. And again, we've talked about this on the podcast before. We'll talk about it later in the show. But the answer to this is school choice, universal school choice. Take the power out of the hands of the teachers' unions, take it out of the school administrators, and put it in the hands of people who care about their kids most, parents. During the pandemic, if you were a parent who had means, you would pull your kid out of the remote school and put them in a Catholic school. All the Catholic schools stayed open disproportionately. Parochial schools stayed open. They couldn't accommodate all the parents who were trying to pull their kids out and put them into those schools. But you know what? If you were poor, you didn't have those options. So, you know, everyone who's talking about, you know, systemic racism and all of these problems in this country, well, if you want to know the most systemically racist problem we have in this country, it's the public school system and the denial of choice to Black kids, minority kids, and only allowed for white wealthy parents. If you're really concerned about racial inequity, you should be a champion of school choice. Because those are the parents who will be most empowered, because the disproportionately white, disproportionately wealthy parents already have school choice. They can do it tomorrow. It's the minority kids and kids in the poorer schools who don't have choice. So the absence of school choice is racist.
I mean, it certainly has a racist impact. And I think that there's no denying the data behind that. I want to leave everybody, first of all, after our interview with Nat Malkus, who I will introduce in just a second, I want to talk to you, Mark, about the ongoing battle about admitting that lies were told, that censorship existed when scientists tried to emphasize that kids should be in school. But we'll talk about it after the interview. One statistic for our listeners, okay? Chronic absenteeism, right? So kids not being in school, missing more than 10% of school, it improved. It went way downhill, obviously, during the pandemic. It improved somewhat in 2023. It remains right now, okay, in 2024, at 76% higher than it was before the pandemic. I mean, if you think about what the impact is on kids, it's just absolutely staggering. So our guest today, however, who actually has written on this and knows a lot more about it, and we dive into this topic, is Nat Malkus. He's a senior fellow and the deputy director of education policy at the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank with which we have some familiarity. His specialty is empirical research on K-12, and that's really important. That's data-driven research and outcomes. He's a national expert on a range of ed issues that affect students, including career, technical education, AP, and most importantly for this conversation, how schools responded to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Here's our interview. Nat, welcome to the podcast.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Mark.
So happy to have you. So there was a big story in the New York Times in which they reported, quote, "Today, there is broad acknowledgement among many public health and education experts that extended school closures did not significantly stop the spread of COVID, while the academic harms to children have been large and longstanding." This is news to many in the New York Times, though not to our friend Dave Leonhard, who's been reporting on this in his newsletter there. It seems like we had podcasts on this during COVID, which we're warning about this, and it seems like everybody who's been warning about this has been vindicated. The Republican governors in red states who opened schools have been vindicated, and the Democrats who kept them closed for too long have done immeasurable harm, and particularly to poor and minority kids. Talk to us a little bit about the impact of COVID on students.
Yeah, Mark, we were in the trenches here at AEI. You know, when school shut down, I didn't know what was going on. And so we decided to start tracking it. I sort of thought we're going to be put out of business by the government or some larger research outfit. Actually, the data measuring who was closed in that New York Times article, it ended up being ours because we were the last people to gather this data. And look, were extended closures.
Great for AEI,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, I mean, you gotta plug where you can. Those extended closures varied quite a bit. And look, in the Times, they put up sort of a marriage of some of our closure data with state test score data. And this data has been out for a while. Like, we know this. It just finally made it onto a big splash because it's the four-year mark when schools shut down. And there was a big difference. Look, the sort of most in-person schools, they lost a lot of time during the pandemic. Everybody took it on the chin. They lost a little over a third of a year's progress in math. The ones that were closed the longest, closer to about 57% of a year. That's a big difference. That's a huge difference. Pre-pandemic, we wouldn't expect, you know, a quarter of a year difference for any large group of students. So it did make a huge difference. The key thing to remember, and I want to keep our focus on, is, look, those things were problematic. We have a lot of tough sledding ahead of us to do any catch up on the pandemic damage that we've seen.
So you wrote another report. You've talked about this. Look, you've been on this for, as you said, since COVID began, really talking about some of the problems. What drives me crazy about this, and your research backs this up. You did a report called Long COVID for Public Schools, Chronic Absenteeism Before and After the Pandemic. You know, like the loss of learning that took place during COVID, the absenteeism that has now persisted post-COVID has a disproportionate impact on minority children. This to me is so grotesque, because these are the people who need us the most, not us AEI, although maybe us AEI as well, but who need good government the most, who need teachers who care. Talk a little bit about your research in this space.
That's right, Danny. The thing that I have been focusing on most recently is chronic absenteeism. Now, this is a term that can get mixed up. Chronic absenteeism, it's the percentage of kids at a school or district that miss 10% of the year. And sometimes people will downplay that. Well, that doesn't matter. Well, that's missing at least 18 days in a school year. If that doesn't seem bad to you, just imagine you were running a business and your people didn't show up 10% of the year. You'd be worried. Well, those rates increased dramatically. It was about 15% pre-pandemic, which is not great. In 2022, it was over 28%. And it's still in 2023. More than one in four kids are missing a tenth of the year. This is the long COVID, right? For two reasons. Number one, the learning loss happened because of things that happened. There were acute pandemic responses, right? Oh, we got to be closed for however long or whatever we need to do. There's quarantine, so forth. That stuff has ended. This chronic absenteeism is an ongoing behavior. It's a result from COVID, but we haven't sort of turned back the clock on some of these behaviors. And it's not that hard to imagine. If you miss 10% of school, how's your test going to turn out? Are you going to graduate at much lower levels? And you ask, sorry to be long-winded, it is worse for high minority schools. It's worse for Black students. In 2022, it was 39% of Black students in the nation, but it's gone up for everybody. It's the number one pandemic problem.
You know, it seems like culture is really important, right? What we've seen is in offices, the office culture has changed where, you know, just many people just have never returned from remote work to full-time work. And it seems like the same thing has happened in the schools. Kids who were used to having to come in regularly And then all of a sudden we're in remote school. Now just don't show up as much. I mean, is this a cultural problem that sort of a permanent shift, just like it has been in the workplace, where once you've broken the habit of coming into work or school every day and you don't do it for a while, then you just don't go back?
I think that's exactly right. You know, a lot of folks are treating it like a policy problem. And coming at a cultural problem with policy solutions is like coming to a gunfight with a knife. It's not going to take. I do think that we have some things that are analogous to, well, my mom's not going into work every day because she can phone it in, so maybe I can. The problem is, I think that kind of behavior really hurts kids in fifth grade a lot worse than it does young adults going to work. And so it's a really pronounced problem.
So I asked you when we were chatting beforehand, what kids are doing, because it's not irrelevant. If you're not in school, you're doing something else. And obviously, the less you're in school, the less you're prepared for the world after school. And whatever that something else might be, is preparing you for something that may not be a productive area of society. Do we have a sense, does your research give you a sense of what it is that these kids are doing?
Unfortunately, it doesn't, right? The data that I gather is from school districts across the nation. I got 15,000 districts, but it can be either excused or unexcused absences. We know that both are up. So some of this may be sickness, but some of it's just truancy. But, you know, what they're doing, it's anyone's guess. You can tell yourself lots of stories about that. I have some theories. But I don't think they're filling it with museum trips and, you know, sort of independent study courses on their own. I think a lot of the things that kids are doing when they're not at school are going to be less productive. And of course, it's harder to run a school when you have, you know, a good chunk of your kids absent on a given day.
How vigilant are the schools at following up? I mean, when we were growing up back in the 1880s, truant officers were a thing, right? I didn't worry about them because I was obviously way too afraid to ever skip school except on senior skip day. But other kids, you know, really worried about that, and it was a thing. What happens now if kids skip school, especially in some of these poorer neighborhoods?
Yeah, I mean, there are some threats out there, like the truant officer will come to see you, or there will be some sort of punishment. A lot of those sort of consequences got sort of watered down during the pandemic, right? There was notions about, did they even come to school? They were remote and so forth. And I don't think that we've seen a clampdown, in part because I don't think we saw from a lot of leaders, whether they're superintendents of districts or governors, a hard pivot that said, look, we sort of took a break from normal operations because of the pandemic, and that time is now over. And we are turning the page on it. I don't think we've seen that. So if you're a principal and you bring those consequences, I don't know that you've kind of got the overall messaging, the cultural messaging that backs that up. So we see sort of some of those efforts and I applaud them, but I don't think we see the big push that we need to turn around this cultural tide of increased absences.
So what we also haven't seen is the steps necessary to recognize the damage that the school closures did and add more time in school to make up for them, right? Because the only way you can make up lost ground is by spending more time in school. So, you know, you would think that, well, let's have summer school, let's have remedial classes. You know, the education system should, the hybrid learning and the remote learning did enormous damage. The test scores are down for these kids, particularly in the poor minority districts. Let's make up for that and get them more time in the classroom so they can make up lost ground, because it becomes cumulative, right? If you don't do your reading and math in fifth grade, then you won't be able to do sixth grade reading and math, and you won't be able to do seventh grade reading and math, and you keep falling behind. What, if anything, is the education system doing to make up for the COVID learning losses, and what should they be doing that they're not?
Yeah, absolutely. Great questions. It's sort of hard to monitor, right? The Fed spent $190 billion for public schools, and they're sort of swimming in a lot of money. That was not done well. But from that, we do have a lot of programs that are out. And there's sort of two things that I think we need to say here. First of all, scores are catching up. So last year, we closed these big gaps about a third of the way. That is fantastic news. And we shouldn't shy away from it. The other news is we're still way away from baseline. We have a ton more work to do. And what we've seen is oftentimes when these tutoring programs are offered, there's just not a lot of uptake. Not a lot of kids are taking advantage of these things. When people, when there's some district leaders or states that are pushing for extended time, oftentimes parents aren't dying for it. And a lot of times teachers unions are certainly not looking for it.
There you go.
So, you know, we have a lot of these problems. Look, what do you make of this? To some degree, I chalk it right back to the cultural problem. If we are announcing clearly, we are deeply in the hole in our schools and we have to work to get out of it, then we might see more work to get out of it. But right now, I think we're somewhat coasting. I'm pleased to see moderate recovery with that kind of coasting, but I don't think that we've seen the real sort of forced march that we're going to need to. And who's going to pay for that? The students, this kind of COVID generation, they're going to pay over the long term in terms of opportunity.
Can you talk to us about how they're going to pay? So, I mean, I've seen various studies. First of all, it seems like there was more remote learning and more time out of the classroom in poor and minority communities than there was in rich white communities. So this is disproportionately affecting poor minority students. What is the lifetime cost of these learning losses? I saw McKinsey's study somewhere said, you know, up to $70,000 in lifetime lost income for a lot of these kids. Talk to us about what this will do to them for the rest of their lives if we don't make this up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is a lot of work that I think is important, right? Eric Hanushek says it's a $1.3 trillion problem at the 2022 levels. There's other folks that put it at, you know, close to $1 trillion. Look, those are big numbers, but what they really are extrapolating numbers from pre-pandemic, as if we know what's going to happen post-pandemic, as if it's going to follow the playbook. What we do know, broadly speaking, is that if you have lower test scores and lower achievement, generally speaking, you're going to have lower lifetime earnings. You're less likely to go to college. And those things are going to hit people in their pocketbooks. They're going to hit those students' kids, if they have them, over the long term. These are real effects. And that's why I think it's important for us to treat it like the national emergency that it is. But it's not just an emergency where if we just spend some more money, I mean, we've already tried that. We haven't seen a whole lot of effort from that. I think the missing key is to call on parents and students and say, the key to success with a school is that you do your part. You bring your kid to school every day to learn. You demand that they bring their A game. And right now we're seeing lots of C game and no one seems up in arms about it.
I wanted to pick on exactly where Mark picked, which is this question of teachers' unions. Now, all of our listeners are well aware we come at this from a place of pretty solid antipathy toward teachers' unions, which are all about teachers and nothing about students and learning. But it seems to me that without an admission that there were bad decisions made that were detrimental to students during COVID, you can't actually think up an action plan to fix things for the students who suffered most. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe accountability isn't necessary. Where do the teachers' unions stand on any of this?
Well, I mean, if you're looking for an apologia from the teachers' unions, I think you're going to be left wanting for some time. And I think that generally speaking, they abetted longer closures. I think you can see that in the data, even if it's kind of hard to nail down in particulars. But the other thing that is worth saying is we don't need an apologia from them to see some of these things. Look, the chronic absenteeism, it's bad for those who had extended closures and shorter closures. It's a little better where it was shorter closures, but it also something that I want to make clear that the problems we have right now, they're American. They're American problems. We see them in red states and blue states. They are worse in places that closed. That's true. But the bulk of the problems, we're seeing them everywhere. And so, you know, we can push for some responsibility in blue states. Bring it on. I'm fine with it. As long as we don't sit and say, you know, if they broke it, they can fix it. Because it's a broader problem. And it's not just in disadvantaged schools. These problems are two things to hold in our hands at the same time. Are these problems worse in disadvantaged schools? They are. Are these problems in the schools in your district and in your backyard? They are.
I mean, obviously I'd love an apology, but you're right. I mean, I'm never going to see one from these kind of people because their sense of personal responsibility is not what I think it should be. But it seems to me that if they are the key to solving this problem, if teachers and extra time and extra emphasis on attendance and extra emphasis on content and catching up are intrinsic to being able to solve this problem, then there needs to be some form of cooperation from them. Are they cooperating?
I don't see any urgency on the part of teachers' unions. You can see platitudes, but I'm not seeing the urgency that I want to see from teachers' unions. Look, these are their problems, right? If you're a teacher and you're seeing that 25% of your kids are missing 18 or more days of school, your job sucks compared to how it was when kids were missing less school. These are workplace problems. If we don't express urgency to fix them, then they're not even meeting their members' needs, much less the needs of the kids. So I expect to see much more urgency before we're going to see these gaps close and get us back to baseline. And quite frankly, I think I need to see the same thing from the president. In the State of the Union, he talked about spending $8 billion more on tutoring. He didn't mention the fact that one in four students across the nation are missing far too much school. Didn't put the responsibility on parents and students. Until those messages come, why would we expect these fundamental behaviors to markedly change?
The solution, one of the solutions, it would seem to me, would be to have year-round school. We already know there's a documented summer learning loss, you know, every year from kids not being in school during the summer. You've got, particularly in poorer neighborhoods where they can't work remotely, and so they can't like have their kids at home while they do their remote work. If you have less education, you're in the workplace faster and longer than anyone else is. It's a childcare problem as well for a lot of poor families. Could we ever get to year-round school in this country, or is the teachers' union going to protect that three-month vacation with every ounce of their being?
I don't think teachers' unions are interested in year-round schooling. And quite frankly, I don't think most parents are interested in year-round schooling. It's that thing, you know, change is great. You go first. Who are you going to find to figure out that we're going to alter the patterns of life for entire school district? It's a lot to ask. And on the margins, Mark, asking for an extra week or two is seeming more than we can do right now. So I wouldn't hold out a whole lot of hope for the fix being a switch to year-round school.
So when we were talking before, you said there are a whole series of elements of this work that you're doing, not just on what you're calling long COVID, which a lot of data now is showing that biologically, physiologically, actually isn't a thing, but educationally actually is a thing, right? You said there were a lot of other elements of this. Tell us a little bit about what you've been seeing, because I think the crisis is actually a lot deeper than simply absenteeism.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of these factors, and everybody's going to tell you learning loss is the number one long COVID problem. I keep banging the drum that it's actually chronic absenteeism because you can't fix the learning loss until we address the chronic absenteeism problem. But you're right, Danny, there's lots of other things that went on. One of the biggest differences that I documented by school closures is kids leaving public schools. So in the third of districts that were the most remote, they lost 1 in 20 students over the first 3 years of the pandemic. That translates into closed schools and pink slips for teachers. By comparison, the most in-person schools lost 1 in 200 students. That's a pretty big difference. Now, some of that's population change. It's not all one thing, but a huge factor of that is pandemic closures. And, you know, the other big question that I think we have to grapple with is what schools did with $190 billion, the biggest federal infusion of funds. And look, on the one hand, I don't want to be a superintendent who had to spend unprecedented amounts of money in a short time and not hire a bunch of people, because then you'd have to fire them when it runs out. Not a great way to spend money. But at the same time, we spent it all. And the question about what did we get for it is like really fundamental. We don't know what kind of outcomes we got from it. We don't even know where it went.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what did we spend it on? Do we spend it on tutoring, or do we spend it on new buildings and new facilities? As you say, if you hire somebody, and the money runs out, you have to fire them. But if you build a building, then it stays there. You don't have to pay it when the money runs out, right?
That's true. And the superintendents would tell you, well, I had a 3-year clock on the money. It's pretty hard to design and build buildings. But look, when Congress put out this money, they put almost zero reporting requirements or guardrails on it. Literally. I have friends calling me and saying, hey, really quick, can I buy exercise equipment with this money? And of course, I said, well, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know. But probably, although I don't think you should. You know, it was kind of the Wild West. And it's sort of a poster child for let's be careful with emergency spending, because if you don't have any evidence that it was worth it, why would we spend more money next time around?
So, Nat, exit question from me. I look at this data that you've put out, that the New York Times put out. I obviously see that there are groups that are unwilling to admit that this was a bad idea. Harvard University has been censoring people who have suggested that all of this school closure was a bad idea. Because, of course, we have to get something bad in about Harvard University in every one of our podcasts now. It's become our touchstone. But what I don't understand is if you take that learning loss, you take the chronic absenteeism that means that no matter what you plug in to try to make up for the learning loss, they're not there to pick this up. You then take changing attitudes towards work and going to work, right? Which we're increasingly seeing. The glorification of quitting, the fact that enormous percentages of Gen Z actually still live with their parents. Where do we end up as a society? The United States has been built on the back of a smart, growing, productive people. It seems to me like we're not going to be feeding the engine for that unless it's through immigration. And even that's completely screwed up. Where does this leave us?
Well, in a very hopeful position after that. Look, I'm not the most popular guy at cocktail parties for like the past 4 years. And there weren't many 4 years ago. But whenever I got into one, I was always telling sort of bad news about schools. And look, there is some bad news. There are some things to be somewhat positive about. We are seeing somewhat of a rebound. But I'll tell you, part of this is just about personal responsibility. A lot of the chronic absenteeism problem that I'm worried about, it's a problem for your kid, listener. If you're not getting your kid to school, it's going to hurt them. It's certainly going to hurt our institutions. We can talk about it at 30,000 feet. But look, I have a lot of friends, and they are guilty of sort of a casualness about school and about the responsibilities post-pandemic. And in a world where that is getting a little bit less common, I think it's incumbent on us to actually take these things seriously. And look, get your kids to school every day. That's how we build this thing up. Danny, if I had some stirring solution right now, I'd be trumpeting it. But I start with a little personal responsibility, and let's build from there.
I know Danny said it was our exit question, but I still have a couple to close out on. But since you raised the magic solution issue, isn't the magic solution school choice in so many ways? It's maybe not a magic solution, but you're seeing now in Iowa, Kim Reynolds has passed universal school choice. She actually primaried all the Republicans in her party who were opposing it and got it passed through. Governor Abbott just primaried 10 Republicans who were opposing a universal school choice bill in Texas and beat them all. And it looks like they're going to be able to pass universal school choice. It seems to me like one of the problems during COVID, during the lockdowns, was that the wealthy parents whose kids were not giving remote learning could pull their kids out of public schools and send them to private and parochial schools that were in session. Like the Catholic schools were all open during the pandemic, but poor parents couldn't do that. You know, isn't part of the solution here take the power out of the hands of the teachers' unions and the school districts and put it in the hands of the parents who probably care more about their kids than the union bosses?
Well, there's two things to say here, Mark. So first, I'm a in-the-weeds private school choice guy, so I think how we do these programs matters. But I'll also say that a lot of parents in these schools that were closed for an extended period, about 1 in 20 of them, exercised school choice without a private school choice program. They left these schools, and you can bet that they were disproportionately advantaged. So it's not a question, did this happen? Oh, it happened. It happened a lot. And the question about the justice of that, I don't think is that hard to argue. The alternative thing to say here is that there just wasn't enough supply of private schools in the pandemic to meet the need. So a lot of folks couldn't find a slot. And there were lots of sort of these micro schools that would open or some other sort of hybrid homeschooling, all kinds of things increased, and homeschooling shot through the roof. So I think a good, healthy private school choice ecosystem is essential. Is it a magic solution? I don't know how long we'd have to wait for things to develop such that we'd have enough private schools to fix this chronic absenteeism problem. So I think we need to preach it pretty hard and work on school choice at the same time.
Okay. And then my actual exit question. One of the damages from the school closures and the remote school was not just learning loss and loss of time in the classroom. It was an acute mental health crisis with these kids. Kids were kept out, not just from their classrooms and from their learning. They were kept out of clubs. They were kept out of sports. They were kept out of interaction with other kids and with their classmates. And that seems to be a lasting effect on a lot of kids. A mental health issue, especially for teenage girls, is through the roof. Is that something that's contributing to this absenteeism? And how do you see that playing out? And what can we do to help address that?
Mark, I collect data at 30,000 feet. So schools just don't collect good indicators of mental health. And so from a data perspective, I can't say much on that. And from a non-data perspective, I can say, of course, Mark, it's absolutely connected to their mental health. Look, they spend a ton more time on screens. Yeah, and we think about this, oh, well, it's their cell phone. It's also that they're still doing just a ton of their schoolwork on these screens that we bought them during the pandemic and are keep running on. A lot of school runs through computers and in my mind shouldn't. And there's a question about, well, what's the chicken and the egg here? Is it mental health is causing chronic absenteeism or chronic absenteeism is contributing to mental health? I think it's probably sort of a both and situation. But a lot of parents I will hear say, look, my kids are having mental health problems, so we need to give them mental health days. We need to give them breaks from school. And
yeah, look, that's the answer.
Yeah, it's not the answer. Look, being engaged with community is what we need to do. You need reps, you need practice. And I think this is not sort of a clinical recommendation, but I think is sort of a population solution, consistently belonging to a community and rebuilding those communities so they're important, so that kids are engaged. That's going to help turn off the phones and turn up the indicators of mental health over the long term. I think schools are great. I love schools. I love school when I was in it. My kids loved their school. And I want your kids to love their school. And part of that is showing up and working at it every day. So I think that's part of the way forward.
Amen. Danny?
Amen from me too. This is great work you're doing. It's really, really important. It's only when we shine a light on this that we can begin to talk about how to get out of it. Because otherwise, we just wait for these poor kids to become non-productive members of society. You're right about personal responsibility. And that's also the answer to the thing that I was complaining about, which is, you know, kids in Gen Z who are out of college, who went to some of the most elite institutions and who think the world owes them a living of, you know, full salary and benefits for, you know, 20 hours a week. Sigh. Rant. That's basically what we're doing.
We have time for that later. We don't have to impose ourselves on that.
Thank you. Thank you for doing this great work. Thank you for joining us on the pod. Thank you for being part of AEI. I'm hugely proud that we do this work and really glad and bummed that no one else does it as well, because it would be good if lots of people were doing it.
Amen.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
All right, Danny, you warned us you had a rant. Let's have it.
I have a rant.
Let's have your rant. Everyone wants to hear you rant.
I always
have. That's why they do. That's why they tune into the podcast, Danny. They want to hear you rant. So give us an epic one.
You know you love it, is all I can say. So listen, first of all, I teased the fact that I was going to rant about Harvard. Really, really important article in City Journal that just came out last week called Harvard Tramples the Truth. So this is the
story. That could be on many topics. That could be on Israel. That could be on foreign policy. That could be on American history. But what is it on this time?
Yeah, no kidding. It really is unbelievable, isn't it? So Martin Kulldorff, biostatistician, infectious disease epidemiologist, fired from Harvard for, quote, clinging to the truth as the world lost its way. That's what this article says, during COVID. So he had written that it was clear by 2020, as you said in our intro, it was clear by 2020 that the virus would spread across the globe. And he used the example of Sweden and said, Sweden kept school and daycare open for 1.8 million children ages 1 to 15. Nobody in that cohort in 2020 in Sweden died. Not the kids, and even more importantly, not their teachers. Their teachers had the same mortality rate as every other profession. Get what happens to this guy, okay? Not only does he get fired, he gets censored by Twitter, I'm sure at the behest of the government. He wrote the Great Barrington Declaration, which you and I talked about a lot at the time with two other epidemiologists from Stanford, and he was mercilessly attacked. Okay, lost his job, lost his credibility, censored from Twitter, not allowed in the trends. And now we have talked about what the impact was of this for this entire podcast, and it's all based on a lie. How gross is that?
There were so many lies told about this. I think this is a subject for another podcast, but we can touch on it here briefly, which is this collusion between social media and the government to suppress information that they deemed inaccurate or disinformation or whatever. And in almost every case, it turned out, from the COVID effects, from the Wuhan lab leak to, you know, the Hunter Biden laptop story. This is a wide range of stuff. In almost every case, the information they suppressed turned out to be true, and the information that they promoted turned out to be untrue. You know, you've got the echo chamber of liberal elites who want to control what information you're allowed to hear, and they're often wrong when you look back on it. The U.S. government keeps statistics. The CDC keeps statistics on childhood deaths from COVID. And they would always say, well, there have been 500 deaths or 1,000 deaths of children under 18, much less than the overall population. You know what they don't track? How many of those kids had underlying medical conditions? Because you just mentioned that Sweden, nobody died. I would bet you a significant sum of money that if we had the data, it would show that not a single child in the United States of America who didn't have an underlying medical condition, cancer, leukemia, some other, you know, underlying condition, died of COVID. And if there was, it was very, very small. The CDC doesn't keep that data. It doesn't exist here. It exists in Germany. It exists in Europe because they tracked it and they found that nobody died in those age cohorts. And we kept them out of school for nothing. And the people who tried to raise the flag and say,
right,
you're making a mistake,
what happened,
were, you know, you're a COVID denier, you're, you know, anti-science. And we just learned how much BS was thrown at us during this pandemic. And this has also put our country in danger, not just in the learning losses, but in the fact that nobody believes experts anymore.
Right. That's exactly right. Because they had no regard for whether it mattered or not, because they thought that they would always be the people who were preferred by elite institutions. I hate to sound like a paranoiac and a conspiracy theorist, which is what these people have. But no, I'm not.
I'm not.
There's data behind this. So actually, just this week, the Supreme Court heard an argument on the question of whether it is legal for the government to flag what they call potentially harmful posts to social media companies without turning it into unconstitutional coercion, right? And so all of the things that you've just been talking about, when Ron DeSantis brought a bunch of scientists in and they started talking about whether mask mandates were effective, and that got censored from YouTube. Whether, you know, there were a whole, obviously, endless numbers of stories about this, and now it has come out that it was the government who was going to YouTube and to Facebook and to Twitter and saying, hey guys, you know, we know that you believe the science like we do, right? All of those schmucks jocks who had their signs up on their lawns telling us how virtuous they were. So that complaint is now before the Supreme Court. I cannot.
It doesn't look like the justices were very positive about the case. Based on their questioning, it looks like they're going to rule the wrong way on that. But it's not. It wasn't just, hey guys, you might want to rethink what you're doing. It was literally emails from government officials saying this still hasn't been taken down. Why not? Literally hectoring them. And by the way, if that was happening in the U.S. government, a total non sequitur, well, not a non sequitur, but an aside here, if you think that was happening with the U.S. government to social media companies, imagine what's happening between the Chinese Communist Party and TikTok. Because I don't think they're quite as friendly when instructing them on what to put up and what not. But yeah, it doesn't look like they're going to win that. But the other issue was that it's not just an issue. I know the Supreme Court case is about government coercion. They had willing co-conspirators in these social media companies. They were more than willing to take this stuff down and toe the line. And this is why the left has lost its head over Elon Musk buying Twitter, because now there's a social media company that everybody uses that they don't control. And they can't direct what to say and what not to say. But that's a topic for another time. But to close on your very good point at the end, it's like, yeah, we do need these people to admit their mistakes. Because if they don't admit their mistakes, there's no accountability. And they are responsible for this unbelievable damage. Our schools weren't doing great before the pandemic. So we didn't have a lot of, you know, we didn't have a lot of wiggle room to sustain these losses. Our kids' mental health wasn't great before the pandemic, so we didn't have a lot of room to sustain more losses. And they just piled on and did so much damage to these kids. And the people who did this need to be held accountable. The people who lied about this need to be held accountable. They need to be, and you know, they need to be called out. They need to be, you know, drummed out of their positions. And the teachers' unions' backs need to be broken, because they're the ones who kept these schools closed. And we need, the way you break their backs is put parents in charge of their kids' education, because they're the ones who love their kids more than anybody.
On that beautiful, sentimental note, let us end another week and say thank you to our listeners. Thanks for being with us. If you have any comments, let us know. Read our Substack. Sign up. You know the drill. Take care of yourselves.
Take care. See you next week. Let us know what topics you'd like us to cover. You can get in touch with the show by emailing us at whatthehell@aei.org.
Or you can reach us on Twitter. I'm at D. Pletka.
And I'm at Mark Thiessen. That's Mark with a C.
Please rate and review the podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe, share it, comment on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to this.
Thanks for listening.